Well, good afternoon, brethren. Happy Sabbath to everyone. It's always nice to follow that kind of music. I just love hearing that men's group and hearing their voices. Our Bibles, especially the Old Testament, are filled, of course, with colorful stories of many people's lives. Very colorful, very meaningful stories, very interesting stories, stories that draw us in, stories that draw us into the human interest of the situation, the details of people's lives, so much so that even the secular world looks upon the literature of the Old Testament as great literature. They look upon especially the Old Testament and the stories that are there and the meaning of the stories and the fact that they have moral issues involved as well as some of the world's greatest literature. In fact, they often comment that, you know, how do these Hebrews do it down there, you know? They got the Babylonian Empire and the Syrian Empire and the Egyptian Empire all around them, and these guys don't produce good literature. It's this bunch of little Hebrews that produce good literature. And they refer to it as the Hebrew miracle. How is it that these bunch of plow jockeys and shepherds could come up with this kind of literature? So even the secular world, while it doesn't believe that God inspired these messages or these stories, or for that matter, that they're even historically accurate, the secular world recognizes the value of great human interest stories that give us moral teaching. And of course, we as God's people then obviously take special note of these stories because we know they're inspired by God, we know they really happened, and we know that God wants us to learn from them. And we particularly probably are drawn then to the examples of righteous and godly men and women that we can look to and learn from and try to emulate. And so recently, for whatever reason, I don't actually remember, but I got myself drawn into studying again the life of King David. And I don't even remember the reasons why I ended up getting started on that, but the more I read and the more I studied of David's life, I was struck by and even moved deeply by the many examples of godliness in David's life. And by that I mean, in a sense, the part that strikes one is the deep personal relationship with God that David seems to have on so many occasions. And you see it in his behavior. You see it in his attitude. You see it in his actions, time and time again, this very personal relationship. So today I'd like to see if we can all learn from some of these examples in David's life. So our goal is really quite simple. Our goal will be to see if we can learn from these examples for ourselves a deeper personal relationship with God, to develop, to find a way to develop, to learn from David's example, to develop a closer, more personal and intimate relationship with God. And in doing so, of course, to develop more godly values in our own thinking. And if you're visiting from Bakersfield, I apologize for your having to hear the message a second time. Hopefully we can all learn from it. But if you'd like to put a title on this, one that kind of stuck in my head as I played with the idea, is Developing the Heart of a Godly King. Developing the Heart of a Godly King. Because we know, obviously, David was one of the few and most outstanding of the kings of Israel and Judah, who was godly. So many were not. So many in our world throughout human history are not godly in leadership. And we know that we also want to aim for the ultimate goal, not only, as Mr. Rudez pointed out, that we can be teaching and influencing others in our lives now, very importantly, but we look to a time in which we can participate in God's kingdom and have responsibility to teach and guide others. So that seems to be one that helps me get the message stuck in my head. Maybe it'll be helpful to you as well. So let's begin our story in 1 Samuel 25, 1 Samuel chapter 25. What we have here at this point in David's life is a story that could have been very tragic, but thankfully turns out differently. And it's a case where David overreacts in anger and losing his temper and he's about to make a very terrible mistake. He's about to shed innocent blood. Why? Because of vengeance for an insult. Now, the backdrop to this story is that David and his men, who now number about 600, are living in a wilderness area where they're hiding from Saul. And a little bit more of the backdrop, of course, as we know, this is early in David's life, but still a number of years into the time in which David has already been anointed by Samuel as the future king of Israel. And then, of course, he slays Goliath and becomes a national hero overnight. And Saul takes him into his court for a period of time. And Saul then even begins to assign him the duty of being a commander over a number of forces, apparently 1,000 men or maybe 2,000 men, depending on which time we're talking about. And he becomes a warrior in battle for the nation of Israel. And time again, he wins battle after battle after battle, to the point that he exceeds many of the seasoned commanders around him and his ability to win because God is with him. So he's become a national hero by this time. Everybody in the nation knows who David is. It's kind of like the Prince William and Kate story of our day. All the young ladies wanted to marry Prince David in that sense. He's a national hero. He's somewhat of a celebrity. But the problem is Saul eventually builds more and more hatefulness towards David, is vengeful towards him, and he eventually tries to kill David so many times and even gets others in his court and others in the military involved in trying to kill David that David has to flee permanently from Saul to save his life. So that's the status that we're in at this point. He's in a wilderness area in Israel. It just so happens that in this particular case, he is living in an area with his men that happens to be near a wealthy landowner. And this man's name is Nabal. And verse 2 of 1 Samuel 25, verse 2 of 1 Samuel 25 introduces us to this guy. And it says he was very, very rich, and he owned much land and thousands of sheep and goats. So even in today's terminology, if you're in the agricultural business and you own thousands of sheep and goats, you're going to have a fair amount of wealth. In that day, of course, it was preeminent. So we see that this is the situation. But verse 3 tells us something else about this guy. Verse 3 of 1 Samuel 25 points out that he was also a harsh and evil individual. That his own servants testify the fact this guy is harsh and nasty and evil. Later we find the story his own wife testifies the guy's a nasty dude. And everybody in the neighborhood knows this guy is a nasty individual. So that sets the context. So David, the other part is, has been for some time, probably a number of weeks or months, has been living in this area with his men, hiding out there. And what's he been doing for this fellow? He's been providing free protection to this man's land, property, servants, and whatever. From whom? From the bands of roving bandits and thieves, like groups of Philistines, who are very happy to come tearing into your town or village or your ranch or plantation and empty you of your wealth. This goes on continually in this land. In fact, not only Philistines, but remember the story is that Israel didn't obey God. They didn't drive out all the various Canaanite groups. So there's a whole bunch of different tribal groups that live there, and each one is very happy to go prey on the neighbor. You don't attack your own people. You just go down the road and attack another tribal group and steal their wealth. It's the kind of thing that goes on in the Middle East at that time, and probably a whole not a whole lot different than the Middle East is today. But this is the reason that this man has benefited from David. Because David and his warriors, remember he's had a long reputation at this, have built such a reputation that all the bad dudes stay away. They don't want to be near David and his warriors because they fear them. So this man has been benefiting in that sense from free protection from David and his men. And as we read the story, we know that his servants remind him of that. That his servants know they've had a relative time of peace and prosperity because of David and his men being nearby. So then, as the story develops, David sends over some young men to ask this guy, Nabal, for some gifts of food. It is not because his men are necessarily starving, but rather verse 8 tells us it's a feast day. Now, the sense of it, the commentaries and all, is it's not a holy day, but it's a feast day, maybe a new moon celebration, maybe a regional or local festival of some kind, like we might have in towns across America in a given season of the year for the birthday of the town or whatever. Who knows what it is? But it's some kind of a feast day. And so David asks, knowing he's been providing this guy a lot of benefits, that it might be nice if his men have a little something special. And knowing this guy has abundance of wealth, he asks politely, very tactfully, and you read the story, he instructs the 10 young men to be very tactful, very polite when they go to ask for this as a gift to David's men. But Nabal not only refuses the help for David's men, knowing full well the story that David and his men have protected him for some time, but Nabal goes on to heap insults on David and his men. So this is why David then becomes enraged. And he decides to kill Nabal and all males in his household. Now, what does that mean? We see the book of Judges. We've done a series of studies in recent Bible study series on the book of Judges. And we see this occur a number of times. It was a practice, essentially, in the ancient Near East. If someone offended you or did you harm, you slaughtered everybody in the household. David's actually narrowing it down a bit. He's only going to kill the males, which means that every male servant will die. It means also that if there are male children of the servants, they will die. It means if grandma and grandpa are in town, grandpa dies. If Uncle George and Aunt Susie are visiting, Uncle George dies. So you see the picture. This is the way it's done when you're a warrior prince and you've got a military command under you and you need to maintain fear in the hearts of your enemies. David gets carried away. He doesn't think the way God thinks. So what happens here? Well, the story is that Nabal has a wonderful wife. And she's not just only good looking, as the story tells us, but she's a wise and godly woman. And what does she do? She loads up a whole bunch of donkeys, piles them down with a couple of 100 pounds of food and supplies and goodies, and heads down the road to meet David. And she does meet David because he's coming up the road to slaughter. But it's not just the abundant offering of goodwill that changes the day. It's what this lady has to say. So let's notice in verse 28 of 1 Samuel 25. Verse 28, she says, and it actually this conversation begins slightly earlier. We won't take that time to read all the verses. But she says, basically, she starts by saying, I found out later what my husband did. Please let me take the responsibility. I'm bringing a proper offering to honor your men. Please let me take the responsibility because my husband failed. And in verse 28, she says, please forgive. She's continuing the conversation. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord, meaning David, an enduring house. That's an interesting phrase, an enduring house, meaning I know God's promises. You know God's promises. Let's not forget, God will give you a dynasty. He's already promised you the kingship. He will give you an enduring dynasty of your generations, of your sons to follow. She knows the story. She knows the lessons that Samuel and others have taught about David. She knows God's hand is here. She's attentive to what God is doing here. So she says, the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord, meaning the king, fights the battles of the Lord. And of course, the word there is Yahweh. And evil is not found in you throughout your days. Meaning what? David, thus far, has a sterling record. He has been righteous. He's been upright. He's respected and loved by all throughout the nation. Let's skip over then to verse 30 to continue the thought. And it shall be, this is her continuing to speak, it shall come to pass when the Lord has done for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you. Again, she knows all this intimate detail of what God is doing here. And has appointed you ruler over Israel. Verse 31, that this will be no grief to you, nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord has avenged himself. Meaning God commanded specifically against acts of vengeance. God had told the Israelites he would take care of the vengeance. So what's going on here? What's the focus here? That David not have this horrible stain on his record. She sees the integrity of the man. She sees his great strengths. She sees his reputation and the blessings that God has given to David thus far. And she's trying to protect David from doing something really awful. That, yes, it won't change the promise of God. He'll still be king. He'll still go on to have sons to be king after him. But he'll carry that stain the rest of his life. And it will also be a stain in the minds of other people that he has shed innocent blood in revenge. Now comes David's response. And this is the really interesting part. In verse 32, we have David's response. What is David's response to this wonderful message? Blessed is the Lord God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me. What are the first thoughts out of David's mind? The first words. Not to praise her even. Not to thank her for this wonderful advice. His thoughts are, God has had a hand in this. God has brought her here. God has looked out for me. So his first praise is to the God of Israel. That's his entire focus in his head immediately. It's almost like the hand slapping the forehead. Oh no, what was I about to do here? He suddenly grasps it, but he immediately and instantly recognizes that it's God's hand. That it's God's mercy, God's love to help him and spare him from a great tragedy, as well as to spare a lot of other innocent people from that tragedy. And then verse 33, he goes back to addressing her after he addressed God. Verse 33, and blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you've kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and avenging myself with my own hand. So we see that David does praise her. He does thank her. He's very appreciative. He honors her. But he knows that it's God's hand that has helped him. Now these are the kinds of stories that you don't just read casually. These are the kinds of stories that make us think about what's going on. And if we think about this, we realize and we sense almost immediately that David must have a very close sense of his relationship to God. That he must have a very intimate, fine-tuned sense. He could lose his temper, but boy, the moment he comes to his senses, he's right back in his focus on God. And what we have to think about here is, how did David arrive at this? Now, he's still young in his life, in his career. But if we think about this, what's the implication? The implication is David must have built this relationship over time. That he must have built this relationship over a considerable period of his life to have this kind of sense of trust in God, of recognizing God's hand in his life. And if we think about it, we know that the Psalms are filled with many of David's prayers. The Psalms are written, many of them are written by David, and really a great number of them are prayers. And if we think about what's happened here, is what we may really be seeing is the result of David's prayers in action. Why? Because many of those psalms, which we don't have the time to go back and read through, that'd be a study in itself, are prayers like this. God, direct my steps. Please, God, give me wisdom and advice. Please, God, protect me from taking the wrong choice in the road. And you see this time and time again in David's prayers. And so in another way, you might say that these really are not just the result of the prayers, but another way of saying it is these are God's answers, or God's answer singular, in this case, in action for some of David's prayers. Because what's happened is, obviously, God stepped in and God answered his prayers that he'd made an earlier day when he was in a much better frame of mind, not in the day when he'd lost his temper. But God stepped in when he was needed. And one of the little lessons, kind of a side point that strikes me about this, is you might refer to this incident as protective correction. Because it's not the kind of correction where God hits you upside the head with a club or lets the disaster happen and then you're supposed to learn from it. It's protective correction. God corrects the path, causes you to change your course, and protects you from unmitigated disaster had you gone the other way. Isn't that the kind of protection and correction we like? I don't like the big stuff. I don't like being hit by a club. I don't like having disaster and then having to repair the damage later. I would prefer to have God's protective correction, where he guides me, protects me, and helps me by correcting my path, changing my attitude, changing my mind before the impact of evil comes upon me and others. So again, these are subtler lessons. They're not like the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery. These are the kinds of instructions we have to think deeply about so that we can apply them in our personal lives, so we can learn from them. And one of the principles here is clear, that if we think about David's life and how over much time, really as we know, again for the young people, he began his relationship with God when he was very young. From his childhood. And it was over years of time that he developed this relationship. How much more should we be applying these principles, asking God's constant guidance, asking God's constant intervention in our lives to direct our steps, asking him for wisdom and counsel, asking him for protection from our human nature getting the better of us? It's that kind of sense that we learn from David's example here. Now let's look at one other example in David's life that occurs a little later in his life. In fact, it's quite a bit later, and this example occurs in 2 Samuel chapter 16. 2 Samuel chapter 16, and this really is many years later in King David's life. He's, of course, come to be king. He had to unite the monarchy first. Remember, as a part of the backdrop to what we're going to read, even though Saul and Jonathan are both killed in battle, there are members of Saul's family and members of his kinship and tribe who still want one of their people as king, even though the vast majority of Israel loved and honored David. So he had to defeat them. So a number of years go by in the early part of his kingship, in which he has to defeat members of Saul's tribe to actually unite the kingdom. And eventually, after a number of years, of course, all 12 tribes swear allegiance to David. So that's part of the early portion of his reign. Also, by this time later in David's life, the sin with Bathsheba has also occurred. And of course, many years have also transpired since that tragic incident, just to set the place in his life where these events occur. And at this point, where we're going to be breaking to the story in 2 Samuel 16, David's son Absalom is attempting to seize David's throne. There is actual civil war in Israel. And what's going on in the beginning of this chapter is that David and his family, his followers, and a number of his soldiers that were his immediate bodyguard and so on, are actually fleeing Jerusalem for their lives because Absalom has amassed a sizable army and is heading to trap them and besiege them in Jerusalem, and they know that they're better off getting out so they can then ally with other supporters, build a bigger fighting force, and meet them out in an open battlefield rather than being besieged in the city. So as they're heading on their way out of Jerusalem, out of town, of course, there's a character named Shimei who goes alongside the road, and apparently the ground on this one side of the road at least is significantly higher than the road itself. And so he's walking along on higher ground, following the whole group along. And this man, of course, is from the family of Saul. And he goes along and curses David repeatedly and throws stones at David, at his men, at his family. Imagine he's got a couple of his wives with him, their children. And so this guy goes and continually walks along and curses David. Now, we think about this, of course, this is a very nasty and painful and even humiliating time in David's life, because of the tragedy. And the early verses of this chapter talk about David and his family members weeping as they leave, as they walk along the road. So what a terrible emotional time for David. And so, of course, David has with him some of his most loyal soldiers and one of his commanders. Again, these men are very seasoned in battle, very seasoned, hardened warriors. They make an offer to David. Let me go take care of this problem, boss. Give me 30 seconds and I'll take care of this problem permanently. I'll remove his head and we won't have this guy harassing and insulting the king. But of course, David sees the whole situation very differently. Let's read how David views this in verses 11 and 12 of 2 Samuel 16. 2 Samuel 16 and verse 11. And David said to Abishai, who was the guy who just offered to take off the guy's head. Abishai is the brother of Joab. He's one of the top commanders throughout the whole history of David's reign. So David says to him, to Abishai, and to all his servants, see how my son, who came from my own body, seeks my life. Referring to the civil war being led by Absalom. How much more now may this Benjamite, this member of Saul's tribe, let him alone and let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him. So again, even in a time of great emotion, you see David focusing on God. You see David attentive, receptive to what God may be doing in this situation. Then he says in verse 12, it may be that the Lord will look on my affliction and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day. So what we see here really is David's great humility before God. Great humility, great teachability before God. Because part of the story goes back a little longer, and we have to go back to get a backdrop to understand why David's particularly careful here. And it goes back to the sin with Bathsheba. God had told David that as part of his punishment, that someday someone from David's own household would rise against him. He didn't tell David when. He didn't tell him how, he didn't tell him who, but he told him that would happen. Now we need to be careful in our understanding of the situation because God did not cause Absalom to rise in rebellion. What God was saying back at that time and regarding the punishment is I'm taking some of my protection away. And had the sin not been there, God would have been looking out for David, protecting against all these things. God would have known that David had a number of wives, that the individual wives had different children, which led to a pretty intense sibling rivalry. He would have known which ones had the bad attitude, and he would have squelched it early on. But what God is telling David is that because this sin is so severe, and I know that you need to learn more about the nature of sin and take this more seriously, I'm going to withhold some of my protection. So in this case, he tells him ahead of time. Doesn't tell him where and how. So the rise of Absalom in rebellion comes as a complete surprise in the specifics. But David knows the principle. So this is all in David's mind at this time. David knows this story very well. In fact, it's burned in David's memory that God had told him about this and warned him about this, that God was taking some of his protection away. So that's why, in a sense, you can see again David's attitude in verse 12. It may be the Lord will look on my affliction and repay me with good for, in a sense, accepting this man's cursing, accepting God's punishment, accepting God's instruction, accepting that he still has lessons to learn. So what we really see here again, and we have to think about these things, these are not easy to grasp. They tug at our emotions. They make us think. But we have to struggle to fully grasp what God's doing here and what's going on here. And it seems clear that what's really happening, in its simplest terms, is that David is guarding his attitude towards God at this time above all else. He's careful to learn whatever lesson that God wants him to learn. He's very teachable. And a part of this is the sense that at a time of great emotion, at a time of great stress in our lives, it's a reminder with what David is doing here that above all in those times, we must guard our relationship to God. We must guard our attitude. And in that sense, David's pretty well lost everything, at least momentarily. He's lost his kingdom, at least momentarily. His family and those with him are risking their lives, are in danger of their lives. They're fleeing their home. They're packing whatever they can carry with them. And in a certain sense, the physical circumstances themselves remind David that he needs God more than any other time. And so it is one of those times that reminds us all that when there's great emotion, when there's great stress in our lives, that those times, above all times, are the times we want to guard our attitude towards God. Maintain that attitude. Maintain a teachableness. Maintain a humility. And above all, as David says in verse 12 there, he's hoping, he's trusting in what? He's trusting that God will still have great mercy and kindness towards him. Which means David's trusting in the fundamental principle that God's intentions are good, his promises are good, and that he will be able to trust that God will eventually deliver him and bring good out of this terrible tragedy. So these stories, these examples teach us many lessons. We can look at them. We can study them. There are many others we could take time to look at. And they teach us things that we need to learn about and to practice in our lives. Of course, above all, it seems, that very principle of being very humble and teachable before God. Of always watching our attitude towards God. Always earnestly seeking his guidance, his direction, his protection, his help. And in a sense to be reminded of what David has done over the course of his life. And it's found, of course, in the Psalms and the many prayers that David expresses there. The constant need to be communicating with God, to be building that relationship, to be continually asking for that guidance, for that direction, for that protection, for ourselves, for our families, for our brethren, for the church, that these are the kinds of examples we see throughout David's life. And if we can take heed to them, if we can strive to practice these things in our own lives, then we will be learning from David's remarkable example and having a godly heart.